I'm joined on the phone by Chris Tonzing. He's the editor of Middle East Report and also the executive director of the Middle East Research and Information Project, which is a nonprofit, non-governmental organization based in Washington, D.C. Since 1996, MERIP has maintained one of the most informative websites on Middle East politics, culture, and society. And their website is merip.org. And I'm very pleased to be joined by Chris Tonzing today. Hello, Chris. Can you hear me?
Yes. Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much. So you're here today to speak with me about the Iraq elections, which took place at this point yesterday. Isn't that right? It's probably yesterday at this point that the elections took place?
Yes. In Iraq, the polls have closed, and the counting of the ballots has begun.
Has there been any word about which direction the election's going at this point?
No, there hasn't, and we may not. I expect that, you know, initial reports of the results are going to start leaking out tomorrow, but we haven't heard any reports as of yet, and the final tabulations may not be completed for as long as 10 days, even into 2 weeks from now. So it may be a while before we know what the results of these elections are.
You wrote an article called Another Historic Day Looms in Iraq at MERIP.org at the Middle East Research and Information Project website. People can read it there. Again, it's called Another Historic Day Looms in Iraq. In that article, you mentioned that there have been several moments since the U.S. invasion occupation where the U.S. has kind of claimed it was a watershed moment, and this is another one of those. And you mentioned that in all cases, the expectations attached to these, quote, historic days had more to do with managing Iraqi and American public opinion than with political realities. Can you explain that statement?
Sure. Well, I list a few days that have got a lot of media attention, although not as much media attention, I don't think, as this election has gotten over here. And the first would be the capture of Saddam Hussein in December 2003, and then the signing of the Transitional Administrative Law, or the draft constitution, back in March 2004, and then the handover of so-called sovereignty from the Coalition Provisional Authority, the U.S.-British Occupation Authority, to the Iraqi interim government in June of last year. And all of these occasions were supposed to have been turning points for the U.S. project in Iraq of what the Bush administration says is building a democracy and putting Iraq on the pathway to prosperity and stability and security. In fact, after each one of these turning points, the armed insurgency against the U.S.-led occupation intensified, most dramatically after the handover and sovereignty. In the months since June 2004 have been the bloodiest of the post-war period, since the end of the major combat in Iraq. And each of these transition dates has seen an intensification and a widening of the various fault lines within Iraqi society itself about the political future of Iraq. And some of those divides are sectarian between the Sunni Arab population and the Shiite Arab population and the Kurds as well. And the danger about this election as well is, first of all, that we will not see much effect of these elections on the insurgency and the level of violence and insecurity that plagues all of Iraq, but mostly the capital and the areas north and west of the capital. And also the danger is that we're going to see an intensification again of the sectarian and ethnic dividing lines within Iraq. And it appears from the initial reporting on the elections that while the turnout on the national level was high, 60% or maybe higher, it was differentiated across regions of Iraq. It was highest in the Kurdish north and in the predominantly Shiite Arab areas south of Baghdad, but it was lower in the Sunni Arab areas north and west of Baghdad, and also maybe in Baghdad itself. And that leads to the risk that these elections will be seen in Iraq as empowering the Shiite Arab population and the Kurds at the expense of the Sunni Arabs. The Sunni Arabs have been disenfranchised from the state-building process in Iraq to date, and these elections may exacerbate that feeling on their part, which would be a bad omen for the prospects of peace and stability in that country.
So you're saying there's already a major division between Kurds, Shia, and Sunni, and that this might exacerbate that division?
There already is a division, particularly it manifests itself in the degree of trust that that Iraqis have in the government that's leading them and in the future of this political transition that's been ongoing since the regime of Saddam fell. If you look at, we won't know the turnout figures for some time, but if you look at the polling that was done before the election, there was a State Department poll that said that only 12% of respondents who identified themselves as Sunni Arabs believed that these elections were going to be completely free and fair, and that contrasted with 52% of the Arab Shia who believed that they would be. So you probably have a large number of Iraqis, particularly concentrated among Sunni Arabs, but probably some others as well, who think that these elections may have been rigged to favor the favorite Iraqi politicians of the U.S., and not necessarily people who have the Iraqi national interest at heart. And so that degree of part of the reason why the insurgency, the rebellion against this whole process and against the U.S. occupation has continued and has intensified is that this political crisis has continued to widen and deepen, that there's this great gap in trust in the whole process between different parts of Iraqi society. And there's also a gap between the Iraqi people as a whole and the politicians who are working with the U.S. and are going to be part of this interim government that's being empowered today. Many Iraqis of all religious backgrounds viewed these elections as a precursor to getting foreign troops out of their country. And polls show that clearly, that there is very little difference between Sunni Arabs and Shiite Arabs on that point. They all want an end to the foreign occupation of their country as soon as possible. And but the two lists in the elections that are most likely to have won and to have done well have both come out publicly before the elections and said that they will not seek a timetable for an end to the U.S. occupation going forward. And so you could start to see a real gap between the government and the people of Iraq in that respect.
And what would be the consequence of that divide that you describe? What would be the result, do you think?
Well, it's hard to say at this point. Certainly there is a prospect of intensified civil strife between different communities in Iraq. That has already been going on. A lot of the violence that has plagued Iraq in the last several months has sectarian undertones to it. For instance, a lot of the execution-style killings of the newly recruited Iraqi police force or National Guard, a lot of those people have been Shiite Arabs who have been killed, and the presumption, at least, is that they were killed by predominantly Sunni Arab guerrillas. And so that clearly has sown sectarian discord. If you look at the great difference in the reaction of Shia Arabs to the two invasions of Fallujah, when Fallujah was invaded by U.S. forces in April of 2004, Shia Arabs in Baghdad and south of Baghdad were sending donations of blood and humanitarian supplies to Fallujah to help out the beleaguered residents of that city. You know, when Fallujah was invaded in a much more massive and devastating way by U.S. forces in November of 2004, there was marked silence among Shia Arabs. Many Shia leaders issued token protests, but there wasn't, you did not see the same level of solidarity. And that is because Fallujah had been identified in our media, just as in Iraq, as a stronghold of terrorists, of Zarqawi and his ilk, who were going around killing not only Westerners, but also many Iraqi civilians and also Iraqi police recruits and National Guardsmen. And there was a distinct sectarian tinge to that whole story, because many of those police recruits have been Shiite Arab who have been killed.
Much of the criticism that I've heard of the election has been around, for one thing, the fact that how can a legitimate election even be held under military occupation? Some of the other questions that have been raised were, you know, when people don't even know the candidates before the election, how can they be informed enough to even choose? Also, there's such a significant number of Sunni Arabs that, you know, will be boycotting the election or boycotted the election, that that makes it, you know, that raises questions about the legitimacy of it, as well as this insistence of sticking to the date of January 30th. It just seemed like kind of a just go for it all or nothing kind of mentality. Concerned people felt like, maybe as you said in the article, that this was more about American public opinion and Iraqi public opinion than even with political reality. So I guess what my question is, do you think that the Sunnis who, you know, boycott, and some of the others that question the legitimacy of this election, do you think that their questions, their concerns are valid?
Their questions and concerns are valid, and it certainly would have been better for everybody involved if there had been participation was truly national and that was not divided along these geographic and one fears sectarian lines as well. those divisions could portend very black days ahead for the country. And I certainly agree that this the sticking to the January 30th date and the setting of the January 30th date from the beginning were driven heavily by the political needs of not only the Bush administration, but also its Iraqi proxy politicians in Iraq. However, that's not the whole story. If the elections had been postponed, whether in response to the rampant insecurity or in response to the demands of some prominent Iraqi politicians, including the Iraqi interim president, at one point asked that they be delayed. It's difficult to see what would have been gained from a security point of view, since no one thinks that these elections are going to impact the determination of the insurgency to keep fighting. And second, you would have gone against a very persistent and vocal demand from a large portion of the Iraqi people themselves. I don't think that one can dismiss lightly the fact that so many Iraqis did, in fact, go to the polls today and vote, and that many people were very, very enthusiastic about that. And one should also not dismiss the fact that direct national elections have been a call that has been sounded by Iraqis since the fall of Saddam's regime in April of 2003. And that call had been shunted aside for several months by both the U.S., by the U.N., by the Iraqi politicians put in power by the U.S. So in many ways, this election was not simply imposed by the occupying power for its own purposes, but it was also delivering to Iraqis what they had been calling for some time. Now, the irony is that these elections are not putting in place a permanent government which will have legislative powers. It is only another step in the state-building process. This is a constitutional assembly which will appoint a committee to draft a constitution. But it will not. It is not a permanent government, there are, you know, numerous steps left in the process.
Do you think the new government will have popular support?
I suspect that what will happen is similar to what happened with the handover of sovereignty last June. There are some Iraqis, probably concentrated in the Sunni, heavily Sunni Arab areas, who are distrustful of the process, period, and regard the elections as illegitimate because they were designed at the behest of the occupying superpower, and their attitude will not change one way or another. I think for the bulk of Iraqis, the question is performance. How does this government perform? The issues that concern most Iraqis, regardless of whether they're Sunni or Shiite, they're Arab or Kurd, are not these issues of high politics, but rather issues of daily life. And the prominent one, of course, is security, law and order, but there are also other very important ones, such as electricity, pure water, and joblessness. The unemployment rate since the fall of the old regime has been very, very high, in part because of the destruction of the not just the regime but the entire state structure that held up Iraq's very state-centered economy before the fall of the regime, and then the dissolution of the Iraqi army only exacerbated that problem. So these are the problems that most Iraqis are contending with on a daily basis, and they will judge their government and accord it legitimacy or not, depending on how well it deals with those issues. The other issue is going to be the attitude of this new government toward the U.S.-dominated occupation. As I said earlier, this occupation is not popular among Iraqis on either side of the various sectarian and ethnic divides. And Iraqis would like to see it end sooner rather than later. Many Iraqis are deeply suspicious of the long-term motivations of the U.S. in invading and occupying their country, that the U.S. wants to get its hands on Iraq's oil, that the U.S. wants permanent military bases in the country, and other geostrategic ambitions. And those suspicions will intensify as we go forward, and there is no demand forthcoming from the new Iraqi government for a timetable for a U.S. withdrawal. Unfortunately, for all concerned, there doesn't really at this stage seem to be any reason to think that the new government will do better at dealing with these quotidian concerns, or that there will be an overall strategic change in terms of the heavy U.S. military presence in the country.
So
it could be very similar to the handover, that it doesn't make things better.
So as you mentioned in the article, the new government will inherit the nagging shortages of jobs, electricity, fuel, and pure water, and the overabundance of violent crime that have afflicted Iraqi cities since the fall of Saddam Hussein's regime, and you're saying that it's unlikely they'll be able to improve the situation. So are you saying then, and also they aren't calling for an end to the occupation in any kind of timeline, so does that not bode well then for Iraqi confidence in the new government?
There's no reason to think that that these things will get better. I think that there will be a grace period for the new government, just as there was with the interim government that Iyad Alawi heads. I'm not sure how long it will last. It will depend on very heavily on events. But I think Iraqis, like anybody else, are hopeful. Many Iraqis are hopeful because you need to be hopeful. There is always hope, of course. I mean, and there are some hopeful signs on the political front. One hopeful sign is that the Shiite religious parties and others who are expected to do well have been emphasizing in their campaign rhetoric in the couple weeks leading up to the election that they were going to do everything in their power to include the groups who boycotted the elections in the process of drafting the Constitution. And many of the groups who boycotted the elections, whether it was the Sunni Arab Islamist groups or the secular nationalists who boycotted the elections, have also said that they fully intend to participate in the process of drafting the Constitution, even if they didn't vote in the elections. So we'll see how those negotiations go. There has been a tendency of, in particular, the Shia religious parties to regard this process, the elections process, as simply a means of instituting majority rule in Iraq, namely their rule. And if they do in fact make moves to institute that, and at the expense of some of the other Iraqis who did not participate in the elections or have grave doubts about the whole process, then that will exacerbate rather than heal the sectarian and other tensions that have been roiling the country. But there is, of course, a possibility that might not happen, and that we might get on a path towards something better. It just remains to be seen.
So you're saying if those who boycotted the election in terms of running for office and also did not participate in the drafting of the Constitution, that if they are included despite their boycott, that things look better. But if they're not included, that could be further division.
Yes.
Okay. Just have a couple more questions for you, Chris. This is Peace Talks, a show that comes to you every Sunday afternoon from 3 to 6 here at Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.1 FM or freakradio.org. And I'm joined by Chris Tonzing, Executive Director of the Middle East Research and Information Project. He's also the editor of Middle East Report. Any idea what the Election Day violence has been like? Have you heard anything about that? We had, for days before the election, concerns about that, of course, and violence leading up to it, and also kind of dismissive statements from the administration that the majority of the country was secure and that it was only a few areas that were problem. Any idea how that panned out?
Well, the media has been very rosy about that question in its coverage today, but in fact there was a great deal of Election Day violence. There were at least 8 suicide bombings at polling stations, and at least 35 Iraqis, who I believe were all voters standing in line, died today, or yesterday, I guess, as a result of their participation in this election. So there was a large human cost that was paid, and I think that the reason why the media is downplaying that is that there was some fear, I don't think it was ever really a rational fear, that the threat of Election Day violence would depress turnout to the point that it was negligible and that you couldn't really tell anything about the Iraqi people's preferences from who went out, the very, very low numbers of people who went out to vote, or that there would be such horrific and large-scale and widespread attacks on polling stations that the death toll and the horror stories would overshadow the genuine enthusiasm of voters going out to the polls, many for the first time in their lives. So neither one of those things happened. The turnout was not depressed on a national level, and in some ways, the violence on the election day, was not appreciably more horrific than the violence on other days leading up to the elections. I mean, let's keep in mind that there have been steady pace of suicide bombings, car bombings, and other attacks on election workers, polling places, sites of worship, going back for some time now. And so part of the reason why the media downplayed the horrible human cost today is that we've become, in a sense, inured to the human cost of this war, which has been so horrible and which has become almost a daily occurrence for us to hear about bombings and other attacks targeting civilians.
What do you make of the Bush administration claims that it was only a few areas where the violence was very high and that most of the country was stable? You say in your article on the Marip website that about 2/3 of Iraqis live in a district that has experienced violence. So I'm wondering, are Bush's claims correct?
There was a lengthy piece in the New York Times a couple of days ago, which was based on a study done by some private security firms with access to military intelligence from Iraq, which showed that that insurgent attacks have in fact been spread over almost all of Iraq in the last month or so, and that very few Iraqis. Only 1/3 of Iraqis live in places that have not seen at least one of those attacks. It is true that the highest concentration of attacks has been in the areas north and west of Baghdad that the administration and the Iraqi interim government always refer to as the three or the four, depending on your count, unsafe provinces where elections might not have been able to be held. In fact, they were held today. There were people even voting in Fallujah and in other towns like Ramadi and Samarra, which have been particularly hard hit by the post-Saddam violence. But the other way in which the administration's claims going into the election were misleading is that the highest concentration of these attacks was in the most populous part of Iraq, which is, of course, the capital city of Baghdad. Baghdad has been the least safe place, and that is where many of the really high casualty, horrific bombings and so on have taken place. I have not seen information about where the attacks that did happen on Election Day took place, so it's hard to measure Bush claims against the reality of Election Day. But it is certainly true that the whole of Iraq is a dangerous place, not just a few of its provinces.
It sounds like Bush's claims then were downplaying the reality.
Sure. I mean, that's been in keeping with the administration's rhetoric about Iraq all along. They have always accentuated the positive and downplayed the negative and then accused the media of the reverse.
Now, Bush said, I heard this on Democracy Now! Last week, that he made the statement that he would pull U.S. troops out if the new government demanded that or requested that or whatever. And I'm wondering if you've heard that, and also, why would he say something like that? Would he say it because he knows they're not going to make that demand, and it's a good PR thing, or what? What's the meaning of that?
Well, first of all, the administration has made a big deal since last June of the idea that the Iraqi interim government is sovereign, that it has ultimate power over its own security affairs and its own foreign policy. In reality, that is not entirely true, since the interim government has essentially required this 150,000 strong now American Praetorian Guard to keep itself in power, and there's no reason to think that this newly elected transitional government will not have the same requirements for external protection. But it has been important rhetorically for the Bush administration to insist that, in fact, it is Iraqis who are calling the shots. They even went so far as to make it seem like it was the Iraqi prime minister who ordered the invasion of Fallujah back in November. In fact, that was, of course, done very transparently to be timed with the electoral calendar here in the United States. Fallujah was invaded just one day after Americans went to the polls here. there's also the legal question. According to UN resolutions and so on, the U.S. Would have to leave if so requested by the sovereign government. But I think you're right that there's also a colder calculation at work here, which is that neither Bush nor the other U.S. officials who have said that the U.S. will leave if so requested really expect that request to come. And as I mentioned earlier, both the interim prime minister, whose list is expected to do well when the votes are tallied, and also the United Iraqi Alliance, the Shia list, so-called, which is also expected to do quite well, both of those political forces have stated that they would not ask the United States to withdraw its forces. So it probably was. I don't think that anyone in the White House expects that request to come, and I don't think the U.S. military does either, since they have now made operational plans to keep well over 100,000 troops on Iraqi soil through the end of 2006, and many military top generals have said in interviews that they expect a large U.S. presence to remain there for even longer than that.
So it was kind of an empty statement, especially seeing as how the new government will probably want the U.S. to remain there to help prop them into power, keep them in power.
It's an empty statement, but it could come back to haunt Bush, perhaps in the not-too-distant future, if the new Iraqi government comes under significant popular pressure to demand a timetable. The problem here for both the U.S. and the new Iraqi government is that most Iraqis, regardless of whether they're Sunni or Shia, believe that the U.S. occupation is the cause of the instability, the insecurity, and the violence that is plaguing their country, that it is the root cause, that there wouldn't be an insurgency if there were no foreign occupation, in other words. And so if they start, the only reason why they have not been vocal in voicing that demand to date is that they fear that there are elements within the insurgency that have an agenda beyond kicking the U.S. out of Iraq. There are elements, for instance, that are affiliated with the old regime who would like to in particular, make sure that the majoritarian rule sought by the Shia is not instituted. And then there are very hardcore Islamist elements, jihadi elements, who have an agenda of implementing their own kind of Islamic state. Iraqis fear those elements in the insurgency. They do not support their political aims, and they would like to see them defeated. The combination of that and their fear that the Iraqi security forces are not up to the task of defeating those elements within the insurgency has led them so far not to agitate in large numbers for the withdrawal of U.S. troops. But that could change going forward, particularly if the overall insecurity and violence plaguing in the country continues. Iraqis could get tired of and begin more and more to blame the occupation for the ills that are befalling their country.
And in fact, you mentioned in your article that in the week before the elections, the United Iraqi Alliance, or the UIA, quietly changed the second plank in its platform from, quote, setting a timetable for the withdrawal of multinational forces from Iraq to, quote, the Iraq we want is capable of protecting its borders and security without depending on foreign forces. So that's kind of it seems like a trend there going towards maybe ultimately asking the U.S. to leave.
Well, actually, I think that change is a trend away from asking the U.S. to leave. The language they put in the place of demanding a timetable is so vague that it could mean almost anything.
I get it. So they're afraid to really challenge. And so what they're saying is more general in the second statement, actually.
Yes. And the United Iraqi Alliance is hedging its bets there. They were thinking, we might actually win in these elections. We might actually be the government. And we are going to be in the same position that Alawi is in now. We're going to be at danger, at risk of losing power to, who knows, the ex-Ba'athist elements in the insurgency if U.S. Troops withdraw. And so that is why they've... I think that's why they changed that plank.
They were afraid that, you know, it was looking like they ultimately might end up being the majority in the new government, and they were afraid they wouldn't be able to survive in power,
right,
as you say, without an American
right.
guard.
Right.
Okay. Did you have any final thoughts today, Chris?
I think we've covered just about everything about about the story. I think, you know, it's certainly a very important event for Iraq. It's not a cure-all for the problems in Iraq, and I think that you know, time will tell, of course. But I think the most likely outcome is that the same strategic dilemmas that have confronted the U.S. and the Iraqi government for the last year are going to stay in place even after these elections.
Thank you so much for joining me today, Chris. Chris Tonzing.
Thanks for having me.
Thank
no
you.
Problem.
All right. Thanks so much.
Thanks.
Bye. And that was Chris Tonzing. He's executive director of the Middle East Research and Information Project, which you can find at www.merip.org. That's merip.org. And also he is the editor of the Middle East Report, which is put out by Merip. MERIP is a nonprofit, non-governmental organization based in Washington, D.C. It's a completely independent organization. It has no links to any religious, educational, or political organizations in the U.S. or elsewhere. Its funding comes from subscriptions to the Middle East Report, of which Chris Tonzing is an editor, as well as small grants from European and American foundations and gifts from readers and subscribers. The Middle East Research and Information Project, since 1996, has maintained one of the most informative websites on Middle East politics, culture, and society. Tikkun magazine said of the website, quote, "The tone is eminently professional. The site is simple and small. Layout is a pleasure to navigate." The website, again, is merip.org, M-E-R-I-P.org. That stands for Middle East Research and Information Project. It's an excellent website with an enormous amount of information on all of the Middle East from a variety of perspectives. And I strongly encourage you to check that website out, merip.org. Thanks again to Chris Tonzing, executive director of MERIP and editor of Middle East Report, for joining me today to talk about the Iraq elections.